January 17th, 2007. This is Infidel Radio, and I'm your host, Richard Spencer. Tonight we have on the phone with us the three guests, and we're going to be talking about the resurrection of Jesus. Arguing for the resurrection, we have Gary Habermas and Mike Licona, who have co-authored a book entitled The Case for the Resurrection, and I will be arguing that the resurrection is not the best explanation for the evidence that we have, along with Dr. Bob Price, who has also, he's co-edited a book entitled The Empty Tomb, Jesus Beyond the Grave. Thanks for being on the show with us tonight, Bob, Gary, and Mike.
Well, it's a great privilege to be on.
Thank you, Richard.
All right, so for the first half of the show, let's talk about, we're talking about the resurrection. We have to first have reason for believing that the events we're trying to explain were actually there and require explanation. So when we talk about the resurrection, what evidence, well, what are our main sources for believing that the resurrection took place? Gary and Mike.
Mike, do you want to talk about that?
Sure. First, I think if it's okay with you, Reggie, I'd like to just mention our approach to it, the approach Gary and I take to it.
Okay.
And that is we want to focus on, try to get down to the most important issue in this and avoid side discussions. So wouldn't come at this saying requiring biblical inerrancy or trustworthiness or inspiration of any sort, because we realize that a lot of people don't embrace that. So we'll approach it in a sense, how can we find some common ground here? And so Gary has something he calls the minimal facts, and that is facts that meet two criteria. The first criterion is that these facts have been strongly evidenced. They have good supporting evidence, data, arguments in their favor. And second criteria is that these evidences, this data, the arguments have been so compelling that the majority of today's critics, the large majority of today's critics, including rather skeptical ones, grant them as facts. Now, they could be wrong, okay? But all the data, all the evidence in favor of these seem to say that these are historical facts that have to be accounted for in any hypothesis. So that's the kind of approach we would take with this. And when you look at this, we come up with a number of facts. Gary has 12. I think we could put some of those together and just focus on maybe the top three, and that would be Jesus' death by crucifixion, the empty tomb, and the beliefs by a number of people, friend and foe alike, that Jesus had risen from the dead and had appeared to them.
Okay.
Now, when you look at those three facts, we're going to look and say, well, what is the best explanation for those three facts? And it would be our contention that the resurrection hypothesis is the most plausible explanation.
Okay, well, we have a limited amount of time, so let's just focus, we can just take for granted, for the purpose of tonight's show, that the crucifixion and well, at least the crucifixion took place. Let's talk about the empty tomb. As if you accept the empty tomb as a minimal fact, what reason do you have for doing so?
Maybe I can make a comment about that. I usually differentiate whenever I make a list with these criteria and or the data that come from the criteria. I always put a little asterisk by the empty tomb, and I'll say in my count. Now I want to be. Let me just put a put a footnote here by the word count. Counting scholarly heads doesn't prove anything. It only shows where people are heading today, and then you want to ask the question, why are they heading there? And it's the data that's the most important, not the head count. But when you see where scholars are, and I've pretty much surveyed everything written on the resurrection, French, German, and English, from 1975 to date, the resurrection, the empty tomb gets a little asterisk, because while critical scholars have come up with as many as 23 arguments in its favor, and about 14 against, by the way, while they'll come up with that number, a smaller percentage of scholars concede the empty tomb than concede most of the other things in this list. So when you ask me, is the empty tomb a minimal fact, I'll say, well, do you mean more strictly or more generally? In a general list, the majority are still there. But on that third one, Mike mentioned that early followers, both singly and in groups, believed that the risen Jesus appeared to them. That's a very high, a much higher percentage. But I do think the empty tomb deserves to be put on the table as a majority view. And then you have to ask the question, of course, with all majority type questions, is the majority right? What are the reasons for that?
Okay. Well, so you're saying that the empty tomb is actually regarded as historical by less of the scholars that would grant the rest of your historical, of your minimal facts. Is that right?
I think that's fair.
Okay.
But it's still a majority.
A strong majority, too. About 75%.
Okay. Well, Bob, you probably represent one of those scholars who would be one who does not grant the existence of the empty tomb. Is that right?
Yeah, actually, I'm an odd bird to talk with about this because I have almost nothing in common anymore in terms of assumptions here, because the more I've looked at it over the years, from starting as Inter Varsity and Gordon Conwell, up-and-coming apologist, the less confidence I've had in these things, and I've come to think that I was dealing with the whole Easter story as the wrong, in the wrong genre. It seems to me now that by comparison with just a bunch of ancient similar stories, whether you're talking about miracle stories about Asclepius or apotheosis narratives where philosophers or god men disappear and cannot be found by their searching friends, not a hide nor hair of them, and sometimes their post-mortem appearances from heaven to convince doubting disciples and all this stuff. I just think there really is no reason to believe we even have historical accounts of anybody's experiences. I mean, I know where this puts me. I know, like, Bultmann, supposedly the arch skeptic, said, "You can't get back further than the Easter morning appearances to the first disciples." Well, I'm not sure we can get that far back anyway. I don't think we really even have accounts of anybody's experiences here. Every one of these stories strikes me is just cut from the cloth of myth and legend, and it would be, and to quote a cartoon I saw recently, I can't think of who did it, to argue from the empty tomb to the resurrection of Jesus is sort of like arguing from the yellow brick road to the authenticity of the Wizard of Oz. It's just part of the same story. It's not some kind of known fact outside of the story, and it all seems to me now, though I love the story, it seems to me to be fictitious, very powerful and important to me. I don't mean to laugh it off or anything, but it just, even the crucifixion seems so similar to similar scenes in novels and so forth from the period. I just think it's really all up for grabs. There is no way to know, even if there was a historical Jesus, though if there was, you know, who knows? All of this, I think, like Burton Mack says, has very likely been generated from the needs of ancient religious communities and modeled on the similar founding myths of other religious communities. So, you know, anything could have happened. There could have been a historical Jesus, could have been an empty tomb, could have been a resurrection, but I just don't think there's any epistemologically or historically sound way to know this. And the same thing comes up with the Moses and the Buddha. We just don't have the kind of historical source material to deliver us from agnosticism.
All right. Well, Gary and Mike, so if the issue here is genre, what reasons do we have for believing that the stories about the empty tomb are in the genre of history rather than, like Dr. Price says, apotheosis narratives?
Let me make a couple comments about Bob, and then Mike's done some work on the genre thing, so let me kick over to him. But just a couple of qualifications. In our discussion here, empty tomb came up first in the discussion, but I don't want to ever give the impression that I think that empty tomb is how the early Christian story started. I think Bob mentioned Bultmann, who, by the way, in his famous 1941 New Testament and Mythology, the essay that got demythologization going, Bultmann makes a very interesting comment. He says the only historical fact that we can be positive of after the death of Jesus is that certain disciples believed they saw him alive. Boltman, now I know Bob can distance himself from Boltman. I'm just saying Boltman himself, with all his skepticism, as Bob says, took the appearances, the stories of the appearances that the disciples believed they saw him to be fact. But I think I would agree with Boltman and everybody since him, virtually everybody, that the experiences that they believed they had of the risen Jesus, that's what got the ball rolling. And the empty tomb was something, let's say, if it happened, it would be corroboration. They wouldn't start from the empty tomb and then say, wow, what do you know, we have a resurrection. So I want to make that qualification. I would start with the appearances, and I think that's where scholarship is. I think that's where history is. And, Mike, I'll kick it over to you on Bob's genre question.
I think that deals more with the various parallels, and I guess I just hand the baton back to you. But in terms of the genre, you know, Richard Burridge did a dissertation-length book back in 1992 that was updated just a few years ago, I think in 03, called What Are the Gospels? And he had become disenchanted with works by Charles Talbert and David Olney on saying that the Gospels were ancient biography, Greco-Roman biography, and that they contained some historical elements in it for certain. And so he set out to disprove that. He thought these American scholars were just quacks. And he's a classicist scholar, so he had been studying all the ancient classics and knew what ancient biography was, and so he set out to disprove it. And as a result, he flip-flopped his position completely and agreed with them, although he said that Talbert and Olney were mistaken in some of the things that they said, especially Talbert. He had some words for it. But the in that, he says that this is definitely ancient Greco-Roman biography, or a subset of it, that was no different. Had in terms of, when we say a subset, there, you know, it might be different than, let's say, Apollonius of Tyana by Philostratus, or Plutarch's Lives, but it differed from those biographies no more than those other biographies differed from one another. So that's why he called it a subset. So, in fact, Graham Stanton at Cambridge said that as a result of Burridge's 92 work, that the entire New Testament community, the consensus of it, not universal, of course, but the large consensus of the of New Testament scholarship has now done a 180 and says that, no, the Gospels are ancient biographies, and they do contain historical elements. They were written as history. That's not to say that Burridge has proven that everything in the Gospels are historical. We have to, you know, look at various aspects, different stories within them, and look at them individually. But that does mean that these authors intended their writings to be understood as history.
Okay, well, let's do that. Let's take a look at some of the individual details specifically, rather than just speaking broadly about it. What are some of the historical evidence that leads you, Mike and Dr. Habermas, to believe that there actually was an empty tomb on Easter morning?
Well, again, I would emphasize that certain people believe that Jesus appeared to them and that the empty tomb was a backup to that, but I take it you mean that generally. So I think without much question the vast majority of scholars today, friend, foe, and in between, begin wherever they end up. They begin with Paul's testimony. And at several key places in Paul's epistles, Paul tells us, for example, that he was passing on tradition. I'm thinking about 1 Corinthians 2, 1 Corinthians 11, 1 Corinthians 15. In Galatians 1 and 2, he tells us that he didn't run up to check with men for the first 3 years. He was taught by the Lord after 1:16, Galatians 1:16, after the Lord made himself known to him, appeared to him. He mentions similarly in 1 Corinthians 9, 1 Corinthians 15. And he says he saw Jesus, and he understood the gospel because, after all, as he's arguing, he didn't get this from humans or from sitting down and reinterpreting the Old Testament. Jesus gave this to him himself. So he spent 3 years contemplating, and he doesn't explain what he does, but he went apart for 3 years, and he went up to Jerusalem Contemporary scholarship generally places this event at about 35 A.D. Whatever year we put the crucifixion at, it would be approximately plus 5, plus 6, somewhere around there. And what you do is you take a guesstimate on Paul's conversion, plus 3 years, and that's how you get that figure. And in Galatians chapter 1, most scholars believe in Galatians 1 to be the work of Paul, and at least he's reporting his own experiences. He goes to Jerusalem, and in the first instance, Galatians 1, he meets for 15 days, 2 weeks, with Peter and James, the brother of Jesus. And in the context, they're concerned about the gospel, or doesn't talk very many details there. C.H. Dodd's famous comment, they spent 2 weeks together, and it's safe to assume they did more than speak about the weather. Then he went back up to Jerusalem 14 years later, Galatians chapter 2, to, as he says in 2:2, lay the gospel on the table and have the other guys respond. And in 2:6, he says, they added nothing to me. And whenever Paul, by the way, defines gospel, it's always at least the minimum, the gospel data now, at least the minimum of the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ is always there. And so he said these guys agreed and sent him to the Gentiles and Peter to the Jews, and that's the agreement. Now, that doesn't mean they were perfectly understanding toward one another. Peter and Paul have a falling out about implications for, Jews and non-Jews just a few verses later. But on the gospel, he says, Peter added nothing to me, and the others didn't either. And so, basically, I can give you a rundown of this, but a large majority of scholarship today, including some very skeptical scholars, place this discussion about the gospel at about 35 or earlier. And about 35, the actual discussion. Then they ask the question, well, if Peter and James had this before Paul did, Paul was, as you know, kind of a Johnny-come-lately to the Christian message. If they had it later, then they had this before he did. And so you have the following sorts of suggestions when the teaching started, but when the teaching became crystallized into a patterned form. Gerrit Ludemann, the German Testament scholar, says 3 years after the cross. The Jesus Seminar says in their book, The Acts of Jesus, they say 2 years after the cross. Well, I'm supplying the two there. They say it's pre-Pauline, and it's before Paul's conversion. And then just lately, you've had James D.G. Dunn, Larry Hurtado, Gerald O'Collins saying that this was formalized into a catechetical statement. They say by 30 A.D., Larry Hurtado says that there was never a time in the early church when Jesus was not proclaimed as both deity and raised. It goes back to the beginning. So I would say, to put this thing out on the floor, we are mentioning here the people who are in the right place at the right time, people who claim to be eyewitnesses, people who claim to have seen appearances. And again, we have, just because they claim them doesn't mean they make them true, but that puts them out there to discuss. So the people who had said they had the experiences were there at a very early date, and then if you want to bring the empty tomb into it a little bit later, you have three things there: the eyewitness discussion of the guys in question, the date, and the tomb itself. So just to get it on the table, I think that's where much of the discussion begins.
Well, one reason I have a problem with that is the stuff that a lot of people, well, virtually everybody, makes pre-Pauline formulae, creeds, hymns, traditions, and so on, all strike me, especially after reading Van Manen and some of these Dutch radicals of the 19th century, it strikes me as grossly anachronistic. It seems to the very idea that Paul, this pioneer missionary of the dawn age of Christianity, is reminding churches of traditions that he passed on and that he was duly catechized by the Jerusalem apostles with these foundation stones of the Gospels, the death according to the Scriptures, the resurrection on the third day, the appearances and all this, as a crystallized formula. This strikes me as a bunch of big signs that these are either post-Pauline interpolations or just parts of post-Pauline letters. I realize I'm way out there, but I've come more and more to think we are not dealing with Pauline material hardly anywhere, but suppose we were. There's a big problem between Galatians and 1 Corinthians. In Galatians, one thing we are not told that he discussed with anybody during these meetings in Jerusalem was resurrection appearances. It's an inference from the fact that they're mentioned in 1 Corinthians 15:3-11 that, when would he have gotten this data or this creedal statement from the head honchos in the home office? And they figure, well, it must be that meeting described in Galatians. In that case, what was he preaching before this? I mean, he says, this is the gospel that I passed on to you as of first importance, as was passed on to me. Well, what was he preaching if he received this gospel? He doesn't say, as harmonists do, this was the official formulation of. He says, this is the gospel I passed on to you. I got it the same way. Well, that can't be from the same guy that wrote in Galatians, no human agency gave me my gospel. It just seems to me we have to choose between them, and maybe neither one of them is Pauline. So I just see the thing swimming in difficulties, and I don't know that we even have a. I think even the 1 Corinthians 15 list, as Harnack pointed out long ago, is already a composite, dogmatic, tendentious, pieced together item and must be long after the historical Paul. So I just don't see, or I could go on and on, but I just don't see this as likely firsthand evidence. No critical scholars think that we have stuff from John, James, and Peter. I just don't think we have any reason to believe we have any firsthand material from Paul either.
Well,
and we're really just out in the slough of despond in terms of this kind of evidence, which doesn't bother me for the meaning and utility of the documents we're talking about, but historically, I just think we're up the creek on that stuff.
Bob, why would Paul, you said this makes you wonder what he was preaching before that time. First, his trip to Corinth is early 50s, but he says, this is the stuff I received. If he's right in Galatians that he went away with the Lord, so to speak, to meditate or whatever on this material and doesn't show his face almost, or at least not widely so, for 3 years, why would he be out preaching before he was preaching? What I mean is, if the Lord, if he believes this is the same gospel God gave him, and by the way, it's not just 1 Corinthians 15. In several passages, he defines the gospel. And every time, deity, death, resurrection are always mentioned. I mean, by deity, I mean a title. But at least as far as historical facts, death and resurrection are always mentioned. Now, my question is, if he emerges after 3 years with the Lord, Galatians chapter 1, and he goes up to Jerusalem, the Lord's given this to him, he wants to see what the other guys are saying. I guess I'd have two questions. You say, well, what was he preaching before he went up there? He went up there, if Galatians 1 is correct, to inaugurate his public ministry. So he wasn't preaching before that, at least not any great amount that we know of. And secondly, why would he, you know, your question, he received this from the Lord or he didn't. So the guy who said he didn't in Galatians 1 can't be the guy who said he did in 1 Corinthians 15. Seems to me a real easy answer. I mean, I think of Victor Furnish, who, you know, is no friend of evangelicalism, but Furnish says in his book, Jesus According to Paul, he says Paul obviously differentiates between a definition of the gospel, which the Lord gave him, and a statement of the gospel, which he thought the other guys there put into a really nice form. They didn't change anything.
All of that is read in. None of that is said. It's just driving a distinction in because one needs to harmonize. In Galatians 2, he actually says, verse 2, I went up by revelation and I laid before them, but privately before those who were of repute, the gospel which I preach among the Gentiles.
Right. Right.
So he's preaching a gospel, and if we identify this with the time that he got the 1 Corinthians 15 list,
right.
What was he preaching? Because in 1 Corinthians 15, here's the gospel
that
I preach to you.
Bob, Galatians 1 comes before Galatians 2. And so if he's meeting with the disciples at about the 35-year mark, what's wrong with clarifying what the Lord told him, finding out, wow, there's other people in the world who are teaching the same thing I am, especially at this central point? And Galatians 2 is a later statement where he comes back to kind of say, let's make sure we're all on the same page. But Galatians 2, he already got this, time with the Lord alone, not just the resurrection appearance to him or what he says, what he believes is that, but he has the resurrection appearance of the Lord. He's alone with the Lord for 3 years. Then he goes up to Jerusalem. That seems to me to be an inaugurating, a mission or preaching inauguration for him. He didn't get it. You know, there's no 10-year gap here. As soon as he comes out of hiding, let's say, he's got it from the Lord, he's got confirmation from the eyewitnesses, and he's ready to go.
You know, well, it says here in 118, after 3 years, I went up to Jerusalem to visit Cephas and remained with him 15 days, but I saw none of the other apostles except James, the Lord's brother, I'm not lying, etc. Then I went to Syria and Cilicia, still not known by sight of the churches in Judea. They only heard it said he once persecuted us, now preaching the faith, etc. Then after 14 years, I went up, and it's the after 14 years where he says he laid his gospel that he preaches among the Gentiles before the big wigs. So
he's had stage one with the Lord, stage two with the first two guys in Jerusalem, Peter and James. He goes out and preaches, and stage three comes later. Are we still on the same page? Personally, I mean, I say this teasingly, but I say in a lot of lectures, Paul was just a little bit obsessive. You know, depending on what we do with Acts 15, if we're just talking about taking text in a straightforward manner, scholars don't agree, as you know, Bob, whether Acts 15 is the same as Galatians 2. But for those who say it's different, and there's no difference here whether you're conservative or liberal, people just say whatever. But if Acts 15 is a separate account, Paul may have gone up to Jerusalem three times. Now, the subject's always the same, and everybody ends up agreeing when it comes to the more central things, and they disagree on outward-reaching things like fellowship and some other things. But on the gospel, they agree. I just think we have a guy here. This is precisely the guy we want to found the church. He's obsessive. He's very careful. I mean, I picture Peter, if we believe the text, a fisherman, and John, a fisherman, and James, the brother of Jesus, who is he? Maybe a carpenter. And they see Paul coming up the street again for maybe the third time. And I can see Peter going, guys, here comes Paul, you know, the Old Testament guy. This guy just wears me out. Will one of the rest of you talk to him? No, you talk to him. You're the, you know, here's Paul. What I mean is, I see Paul as over the top on this one. I just see him as pushing, and when everybody
you're embellishing the text. This is a classic midrash.
Yeah.
In the first,
yeah, I'm good at it, huh?
Yeah, in the first thing in Galatians 1, it gives no idea of what he may have discussed with Cephas and James. We don't know that he hammered out. I mean, he might have been talking about the weather for all we know. At least we can't say, well, he must have squared himself with them on the resurrection and the deity of Christ. We just have no idea.
The context both before and after that visit is the gospel. Paul just says, the Lord gave it to me. He said, here's the gospel. And, of course, you know this, but everybody else, that chapter division is not there in chapter 2. So just before that 35-ish A.D. trip, Paul's talking about the gospel. And as he begins just minimal verses later, chapter 2, verse 1, he's doing the gospel again. So I think the old hermeneutical rule, interpret a text in its context, if we say, what's he talking about? Secondly, if we say, what was Paul about? You know, I preach nothing but Christ and Him crucified. If we know that's Paul's central message, and the text before and after is the gospel, I think it's a pretty rudimentary conclusion that it must have at least come up in 15 days.
Well, it may have. Somehow I'm getting, my fault, no doubt, I'm getting lost from the point of trying to make contrasting Galatians 1 with 1 Corinthians 15. Because if Paul received his gospel, which, as you say, must have contained the death and resurrection of Christ, if he received that from Christ and is preaching it and then decides later to see what the guys in the home office say, but in 1 Corinthians 15 he says the gospel gospel he preached in Corinth was the one he received from others, and
that's
he
right.
gives it, he stipulates it has to do with the death and resurrection of Christ.
Right.
I say we have a whopping contradiction.
Why?
Because if he didn't, there's nothing about these niceties of, well, I received this this particular idiomatic way of saying it. That's
right.
just a gross harmonization.
Why? No, I mean, Galatians 2 comes after Galatians 2 comes way before, if we take traditional chronology. Galatians 2 comes before he goes to Corinth. Why can't he be preaching in Corinth what the Lord gave him, let's say it this way, what the Lord gave him as clarified formally by his primary disciples? Why couldn't it be that? Why couldn't Furnesh be right that the Lord gave it to him, but he heard this really nice formalized statement, which
it's
is where
most... It's a distinction you have to read in. It says,
why?
Here's the gospel I preached to you, and
right.
Whether I or they, we all agree on it, this is not
right.
the same guy that's talking in Galatians.
Why not?
No matter which of these passages in Galatians you look at, it's just to say that he's just spinning it a different way. There's no reason to say that. What's added on here that isn't in these numerous other statements throughout Romans and Galatians and so on?
Doc, could I jump in here? Okay, Galatians 15, 1 Corinthians 15:11. Whether it's I or they, we're preaching the same message. All right, let's compare that to Galatians 2:6. They added nothing to me. Galatians 2:9-10. They laid their hands on me, the right hand of fellowship, and told me to go out and preach it. Seems to me Galatians 2:6, 9, and 10 are very close to 1 Corinthians 15:11, i.e., on the gospel at least, they were all on the same page.